This is Mete Yurtsever. I'm the host of the Formula for Creating Value podcast. Today, my special guest is co-founder and chief science officer of Capuchin Behavioral Science, Patrick Fagan. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. And let me introduce you to our audience briefly. Patrick studied psychology and marketing at University College London and King's College London, respectively. For the last 10 years, he's been a consultant and a researcher on consumer behavior. A very remarkable post he had, he was lead psychologist of Cambridge Analytica for 8 months until the company went into administration. He's lecturing part-time on multiple universities in London. He has a book called Hooked on psychology of effective communication, the secret psychology of why messages stick. Now you're co-founder and your company, Capuchin Behavioral Science. Our audience is familiar with behavioral psychology, but I'd like to hear from you. Besides it's cute, why you named it after Capuchin monkeys?
So one of the things is that, as you say, it's cute, and we pay attention to cute or emotional things. We're kind of hardwired to do that. But also, there is some research showing that brands that have an initial plosive, so a hard sound at the beginning, especially a k, or just in it, actually, not necessarily at the beginning, they're more memorable, I think, because it's a bit different, a bit unexpected. So you think KFC, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, so there's the k sound. And then also a Capuchin monkey is a real thing. It's a concrete thing. So it's not like an abstract word or a made up word. It's something people can actually picture in their heads.
Oh, okay. So, well I first thought about, I didn't think about the cape sound thing, but I thought it's also like, there are lots of surveys on Capuchin monkeys, right? They are pretty similar in social behavior as human, right?
Yeah, it was. So, of course, it was initially inspired by those experiments. So there's that great one, I don't know if you know it, on fairness, where they had two Capuchins trained to do a task. One of them got paid in cucumber, which it ate. Then the other one next to it got paid in grape. And when the first one got paid in cucumber again, threw the cucumber back at the researcher and started shaking the cage.
Yeah, but actually, I also heard that sometimes... the other one who gets the grape, the sweet one, comes to some terms and he shares it with the other.
Oh, wow. Monkey,
right? That's great. Yeah, I've read something like that. So not necessarily every human or every Capuchin is so selfish, but they sometimes might have some social gifts, maybe.
That's
so, and how you got caught in behavioral science? Okay, you studied psychology, but... how you get into behavioral science?
Well, when I was, it's a bit embarrassing. I'm trying to think how to phrase it. When I was a young man, about 17, 18, I was quite interested in the dating pickup guru kind of culture at that time. You know, teenage boy, of course I was. For all its, you know, kind of ethical and philosophical flaws, it did have quite a good grasp on psychology, and it introduced me to a lot of concepts which have stuck with me since, you know, body language, evolutionary psychology, priming and framing, these kind of things. So I think that's really how I got into it in earnest. But even before then, I was very interested in advertising, how messages can say something subconsciously or subliminally that's different from what they are kind of pretending to say outright. I just always thought that was fascinating. Even at school, I enjoyed English because, you know, a poem would have a subtext and a subliminal meaning that was different to what it was saying explicitly. So that's how I got into it. And then, so I did psychology at UCL, and then I thought, this is great, but how can I make money from it? So then I did marketing at King's. I tried to be in a band, so that didn't go very well, obviously. And then from there, I joined a behavioral science consultancy, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. So now that you're an expert, so how conscious you are about your behavioral science knowledge? I mean, are you getting use of it in your daily life, or you're just a regular guy like all of us?
No, I'm just a regular guy. I mean, when I tell people what I do and where I used to work in particular, they often kind of freeze up their body language. They're worrying about them reading their minds and know their deepest secrets, which to a certain extent is true. I mean, I'm probably above average in terms of being able to read people's personalities and intentions and things, but it's such a, none of us really have the brain power to go around every day like, he has his arms crossed and he's touched his nose, but it is cold in here, so he might just be cut. Nobody really has the time or the brain power to do that, but I'm probably a bit above average.
Sure. So I cannot avoid to ask this question. I'm certain you receive many questions regarding your days at Cambridge Analytica. What is your view on what happened? You have also a nice one. You mentioned in Nutstock, Cambridge Analytica is like a strip club. Everyone wants to go, but no one wants to be seen there.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, so that was in my first week. I overheard someone say that. And what, I'm not saying there weren't any issues in the company and what was done. I think the main, really, what really upset people was the clients that the company worked for. One client, really, in particular, the Trump campaign in 2016. Yeah. And I'm, to be honest, these days I'm fairly apolitical, so I don't have an opinion on that myself. But for example, Barack Obama did a very similar thing in 2012, taking people's Facebook data and using it to profile them and send the messaging. Brands did this all the time, and they do it all the time. And I think an important point to make is this method hasn't gone away since then. It's just actually, it's more people are doing it and it's got more sophisticated. I think if I were to fault the company, obviously, you know, using people's Facebook data that they haven't opted in, which the company didn't collect that, but it did use it in a very minimal way. Completely understandable there's concerns about that. Completely understandable that there's concerns about manipulating people psychologically without their consent or knowledge, which I also have found increasingly concerning. And obviously, some of the secret camera footage was not exactly great. But other than that, it was just really a regular kind of digital marketing company, nothing too spooky, really, to be honest.
Yeah, and I also believe what drew so much reaction is the intention and finally who used it. I mean, like, exactly, yeah. as you said, I mean, when Obama does it, it's Guardian says, oh, it was a phenomenal campaign. And when Trump does it, yeah, okay. We'll come to a bit at the end maybe about the ethics. So also during my marketing practice, I at least in the last 10 years of it, I used psychographic segmentation and realizing that just demographics are, you know, useless, and asking people their preferences is also a waste of time. I mean, like, literally. So when you analyze a group of consumers, you try to categorize them according to their personalities, right? And does everyone use that sort of same profiling, like Ocean framework?
So Ocean is... And for your listeners, Ocean or the Big Five is a fairly well accepted model of personality. So generally speaking, if someone wants to do a study on personality, for example, how it affects the shoes you buy or how often you go to your bank or anything really, they'll use Ocean with a few exceptions. But generally speaking, everyone uses Ocean. And There's good research, you know, decades of hard work to suggest that these five traits, which are basically creativity, which is openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. There's good evidence, a lot of good evidence, that these are the five traits that really make up predictable human behavior. There are some nuances, and there are some other things, obviously, like intelligence, sensation seeking, but generally speaking, these five capture most of it. And also the fact that researchers use this so consistently means that if you use the Big Five Ocean in a survey, you can then make some really good educated guesses about a particular segment. So if you see that a segment is really high in openness to experience, you can look at other research and say, okay, if they're high in openness to experience, they like classical music, They're more likely to like documentaries and current affairs. They're more likely to like abstract and complex art. And you can build on that existing literature to really profile your consumers in a way that doesn't require asking all of those questions in a survey. And so to your question, do people generally use Ocean for psychometric segmentation? I think so. I mean, obviously, I don't know every segmentation provider out there, but as far as I know, they do. I certainly use it in every single one.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that the presence of the all this wide research about using the same, let's say, filters in a way. Yeah. So I'm always asking myself about the role of culture in human behavior. So this using this personality or the Ocean, let's say, does it overcome the culture impact? I mean, an open person in UK and in Turkey react the same to the same message in the same way?
Very interesting question. I think so. I don't know for sure. I think so because these traits, although they differ between countries, so for example, Italians are more extroverted on average, and even within country, for example, Londoners are more open to experience and less agreeable than people who live outside London. Although the levels do differ, the kind of the meaning of the traits stay the same because it's partly to do with neurobiological differences. So openness to experience is, for example, partly to do with tolerance for ambiguity and the ability to pick out patterns in things. So these are kind of hardwired traits. Extroversion is about needing excitement and being reward focused, which is very much to do with certain parts of the brain. So I would have thought that the insights, generally speaking, fit across cultures. The only difference, I suppose, is how you manifest that. So if open people like things to be creative and different and maybe a bit subversive, that probably looks very different in one culture to another because there's different social norms and life histories and things.
Great. So one side question, actually, I don't want to divert from the main focus, but how do you get a hint on the purchasing power? Because if you use it for marketing, I mean, like personality is one thing, but people should be able to, in order to meet the, I mean, the transaction to happen, they need to have a purchasing power.
Yeah.
How do you bridge that gap in a way?
Yeah, so it depends. If the client has data that we can layer into the survey, we can look at, okay, this personality segment spends the most and they buy the most often, and we can size the market that way. Otherwise, the only way really to do it is through survey questions, which is not great, but you can ask, how often do you buy this category? How much do you spend? And then you can use something like the theory of planned behavior to see how likely they would be to buy in the future. So let's say it's insurance. You can ask, how good or bad do you feel about buying insurance? Do you think most people buy insurance? Do you think you should buy insurance? And together these give a bit better predictive power than just asking their intentions, which intentions are really a great predictor of future behavior.
So let's dive into this, how it is done, how the data is collected, let's say. So all our digital footprint is used to know us, our personality, but who has access to this rich data other than Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, or I mean, you need such rich content. And how can you analyze our behavior if you don't have this data? This is what I'm wondering.
You can buy data. It's de-anonymized in theory, but there's stories recently where it's been anonymized again. For example, if you have location data and you know where someone lives, and this anonymous data point is in that location at night when they're asleep and you know it's them. I don't think that's legal. It's certainly not ethical, but it can be done. But otherwise, I mean, for client projects, what I do then is send out a personality survey to their prospects, their clients, their customers. And some of them will answer it, some of them won't. But you have personality and other data on the people who do answer it. And then they'll have the client will have customer data on other things, depending on how rich that is, how good it is, you can potentially model the personality data to all of those other people who didn't answer the survey. So if you find, for example, that you have a really open segment and the customer data says that younger female people who live in the city and have a pet cat are more likely to be in this open segment, you can then model that across the whole data set. So anyone who's younger female in the city with a cat, you can say it's probably in the open segment.
You had a remarkable statement in your speech, I guess last year in Nachstag. So you said, we all know that emotional ads are more effective, but what is the long-term impact of all this emotion? So I never thought about this way, but I also read something similar recently. According to the evolutionary biologists, so the gadgets we use return man into his primitive state and instinctive and the rapid response of signals and of danger and opportunity. So how do you, what is your take on this one? I mean, like the fact that we're using this emotional cues makes the situation worse in a way?
Yes. So there's a great book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. And before that, there was a book in the 80s written called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which was about the same thing, really, and saying about how technology, even moving from print media to television, affects how we think. The medium is the message. And it's not just advertising, of course. It's the news cycle. It's social media. Just this endless kind of bombarding with emotion probably is not all that good for us, because it keeps us in a less rational state. And of course, the whole idea of nudging is that we're not completely rational, and obviously that's true. However, we can be rational, we can be conscious, we can aspire to quite good things consciously. You know, we can build skyscrapers and write plays and sonnets and all of these amazing things. So my concern is that there's really a strong focus on engaging people emotionally, and getting people in a very emotional state of mind. And yeah, I do worry what the long-term effects will be.
Well, I mean, I also think, like, without maybe a bunch of, I don't know, several thousands of people around the world, we would be living in caves. So, I mean, whatever we benefit of this technology, whatever, is not based on our scientific work and thinking. I mean, we would be useless as, I would be useless as a human being. But is there a way to teach people how to act more rationally? Or you still see that this is something that can be misused? And because if there's no way to teach people at every step, or if this is our nature, how we can overcome that nature? I mean, maybe with some technology, I mean, that's inbuilt on us, maybe we can be smarter or inhibit our instincts. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to poo-poo technology. Obviously, it's amazing and it increases our lifespan and our quality of life and opens up opportunities for all sorts of people. Has brought all sorts of happiness and peace and safety to the world. But there, I think there are downsides that we need to be aware of, and I think people are increasingly aware of it. I think there, at least to me, maybe I'm biased, but there seems to be a bit of a movement towards, you know, turning your notifications off, being a bit more careful with screen time for children. Some people, there's a setting on your iPhone where you can make the screen grayscale, so no color, because it's less stimulating. There's obviously the dumb phone movement. You know, these are very small but growing things. So I think, and people are more aware of it, and obviously they're more aware of things like mindfulness and meditation, which speak into the same thing of just kind of taking a breath, relaxing, not letting your emotions get ahead of you. In terms of your question, can we make people more rational? I think so. I think there's a few things to it. One is reducing information and decision fatigue. So the amount of kind of pointless choices and decisions people have to make, if you can reduce that, then they can think for themselves a bit more. Now, in the past, it's kind of been religion has done that for people because it gives people a structure by which to live their lives, so they don't have to think about it. I mean, if you think about, for example, an arranged marriage, think about all of the, and I'm neither condoning or condemning them, but I'm just saying, think about all of the effort and thinking and choice that takes out of someone's life, you know, finding a partner, making sure they're the right person and so on. And so it kind of frees you up to think about other things. Now, as great as I think religion is or can be, technology can also play that role by making certain choices for us, helping us to be healthier, eat the right foods and so on. So I think counterintuitively, technology can actually help us fight the negative effects of technology. It can help us kind of free our minds to be a bit more rational. Unplugging from notifications and emotions, just kind of taking a step away can help because it gets you out of that emotional style of thinking. Reading and just taking time just to think and reflect. I feel like people don't really do that anymore. We're always on. We're always listening to a podcast or watching TV or working. You don't just kind of sit there doing nothing and thinking. So I try to do that more. And then things as well, like having a good diet, exercising, only drinking in moderation, if at all. All of these things kind of help your more conscious facilities to thrive. I think that's it. Meditation is good as well.
Yeah, great tips. Thank you, Patrick. Yes, great. So I'd like to also touch upon, as a last point before the end, your framework of how messaging works in your book called Hooked. Unfortunately, I haven't read yet, but I'll order it. So can you tell us about what are the about the framework of that you describe in Hooked?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's three main parts to it. The first is that you need to grab people's attention because we're all cognitive misers, very limited attention spans. We just simply can't pay attention to all of the information in the world. There was one estimate that, at least from a sensory point of view, so everything that is around you in terms of sight and sounds and smells in the current environment, we can only consciously process 0.0004% of that. Now, that's one estimate. It's not really, you can't really put a number on something like that. But yeah, the point being, the vast majority of it, we're just not consciously aware of, even though we're processing it at some level. So if you're an advertiser or you're sending emails or whatever it might be, you need to grab that 0.0004% if you need to get noticed and even have some kind of response in the first place. And so there's a few ways you can do this. Surprising things will grab attention. So just movement or sound or something that's slightly out of the ordinary and unexpected will grab attention. Emotion, faces, food, sex. There's a whole range of things which you can, as you can imagine, have a evolutionary value for making us look to a spider or a snake, for example. And personalization as well. If you hear your own name, you're going to listen. So once you've caught people's limited attention, you then, the second step is you want to engage them and get them to actually think about what you're saying and digest it and take it on board. And so there's three ways you can do that. One is through fluency, so making things very simple and concrete. So like Capuchin, you know, it's a monkey, it's a visual thing, a real thing. So rather than abstract kind of intangible ideas, making it concrete. Narrative stories are very effective because that's how we process information. And because a story makes you experience the information yourself rather than just seeing it superficially through empathy. And then the third thing is mystery, where if something kind of piques our interest and it doesn't quite make sense at first, then we have cognitive dissonance and we want to solve that gap in our understanding. For example, people still are interested in Jack the Ripper all these years later because it's a mystery. We want to know the answer. And then finally, your message that you're getting noticed and absorbed, you want to frame it and word it in a way that's going to nudge behavior. So that's the third thing, is influence and behavior. And this is all the nudge stuff, you know, social proof, scarcity, loss aversion, etc. Also, you want to make it memorable because there's often quite a time lag between seeing the message and acting on it. And so there's things like repetition and the recency effect, which will make something more memorable. And if it's emotional or intentional grabbing in the first place, it should be memorable anyway. And then since writing the book, one more thing I would add, I don't know which section it would go in, but is relevance. You need to tap into people's motivations, what they care about, especially on an emotional level, and you need to make it relevant to them and to your product. So if you're a funeral parlor, having someone in a bikini holding a puppy in your advert, okay, it will grab attention, but it's not going to build the right memory networks. It's not really going to work.
Yeah, great point. Great tips, Patrick. Thank you very much. It's a very nice summary of the main idea and of whole behavioral science, basically. So that brings us to the signature question. I would like to ask, what is the formula for creating value for Patrick?
So interesting question. Thinking about it just now, I think there's three ingredients. Always try and keep to the rule of three.
Trilogy.
So I'll call it science, gnosis, and sizzle. So science obviously is important because, well, probably don't really need to say why, but it helps you kind of prove what you're doing. And actually, that's where the value comes from, is in being able to set up an experiment and say, this worked or it didn't. And if something works, keep doing more of it and figure out how to make it work even more. And it keeps it accountable as well. So you can't just say things that don't stack up. Then the second thing is gnosis. So science and gnosis actually mean the same thing. It's just one is Latin and one is Greek. But gnosis, the meaning is a bit different because science is very kind of stuck in the material realm. It's, you know, you have to show things that can be observed empirically, which is great, but it's kind of missing a little bit. For example, I talked about Shakespeare sonnets earlier. There's a huge amount of truth and wisdom and insight you can get from a Shakespeare sonnet, but you can't prove it. You know, I don't have a reference for it or a p-value. So gnosis for me is about kind of, yes, science is great, but we can move beyond that a little bit to look at other truths. So this is the kind of truth that you might get from Freud, or even better, in my opinion, from Carl Jung, that there are, you know, archetypes that resonate with people, and you tell stories in certain ways, and people have certain attachments and memories and associations. These things are kind of hard to investigate from a scientific point of view, but not impossible. But I think there's a deeper meaning and a layer that you can add. And then the third thing is sizzle, which is about making things fun and entertaining and memorable and attention grabbing, which I think is important.
It's quite interesting. Okay, great answer. Thank you very much. So, Patrick, how can people reach you if they have any question? I think you are a bit also active on Twitter.
Yeah, if you want to see my half-baked political opinions and conspiracy theories, you can follow me on Twitter. It's pfagan87, but probably, you know, from a professional point of view, I'm on LinkedIn. And I have a website, patrickfagan.co.uk, and you can email me from there.
Great. I'll add all of those in the notes. So thank you very much for your time, Patrick. It was very fun and very insightful. Thanks for coming again.
Thanks again. Thank you.